the Book of Judges. It's a tale of chaos unleashed, of violence unchained, and of a moral compass spinning wildly out of control. Ancient Israel's story? Perhaps. But as we peel back the pages, we'll find a mirror reflecting our own tumultuous times. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Sound familiar? Well, join us over the next few weeks as we study the Book of Judges, ancient wisdom for modern chaos. Our story begins now.
Judges chapter 3, starting at verse 12, going down to the end of the chapter. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. And because they did this evil, the Lord gave Eglon, king of Moab, power over Israel. Getting the Ammonites and the Amalekites to join him, Eglon came and attacked Israel, and they took possession of the city of Palms. The Israelites were subject to Eglon, king of Moab, for 18 years. Again, the Israelites cried out to the Lord, and he gave them a deliverer, Ehud, a left-handed man, the son of Gera, the Benjamite. The Israelites sent him with tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now Ehud had made a double-edged sword about a cubit long, which he strapped to his right thigh under his clothing. He presented the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab, who was a very fat man. After Ehud had presented the tribute, he sent on their way those who had carried it. But on reaching the stone images near Gilgal, he himself went back to Eglon and said, "Your Majesty, I have a secret message for you." The king said to all his attendants, "Leave us," and they all left. Ehud then approached him while he was sitting alone in the upper room of his palace and said, "I have a message from God for you." And the king rose from his seat. Ehud reached with his left hand, drew the sword from his right thigh, and plunged it into the king's belly. Even the handle sank in after the blade, and his bowels discharged. Ehud did not pull the sword out, and the fat closed in over it. Then Ehud went out to the porch. He shut the doors of the upper room behind him and locked them. After he had gone, the servants came and found the doors of the upper room locked. They said, "He must be relieving himself in the inner room of the palace." They waited to the point of embarrassment, but when he did not open the doors of the room, they took a key and unlocked them. There they saw their lord fallen to the floor, dead. While they waited, Ehud got away. He passed by the stone images and escaped to Sira. When he arrived there, he blew a trumpet in the hill country of Ephraim, and the Israelites went down with him from the hills, with him leading them. "Follow me," he ordered, "for the Lord has given Moab, your enemy, into your hands." So they followed him down and took possession of the fords of the Jordan that led to Moab. They allowed no one to cross over. At that time, they struck down about 10,000 Moabites, all vigorous and strong. Not one escaped. That day, Moab was made subject to Israel, and the land had peace for 80 years. After Ehud came Shamgar, son of Anath, who struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad. He, too, saved Israel.
Okay.
I wonder how you'd answer this question. Where is glory found? Just imagine you've been scrolling through social media. Some people might have to imagine more than others. A celebrity flaunts their latest achievements. An influencer, yes, that's a real thing. An influencer is showing off their perfect lifestyle. A friend of yours is boasting about finding their dream job. In that moment, when you see those things, where does glory seem to be found? Is it in fame? Is it in wealth? Is it in success? I mean, how do they get there? What do they do? How can I copy? The temptation to follow suit is strong, isn't it? Now, in the book of Judges, the quest for glory isn't just about likes and followers. It's actually about survival. It's about rest, about peace, about the good life. For Israel here, it's a matter of life and death. And behind it all, the ultimate question is looming: where is glory to be found? As we've just seen, Judges chapter 3 gives us the answer in gory, gruesome detail. And it's not pretty, is it? In fact, it's probably the most inglorious moment you can see in the Bible. I mean, it shows us absurdity, doesn't it? A stupidity. The madness of thinking that glory can be found anywhere else other than God alone. In fact, I reckon this is probably the most ironic and satirical story in the entire book of Judges. Every line of this story is dripping with double meaning, with humour, with satire. But it is all circling around one question. Where is glory to be found? You see, as Israel are wandering around in their misplaced worship, God is preparing to flip the script on their notion of glory. Enter our unlikely hero, Ehud. His name is, where is the glory? See, it gives us the question we should be asking. So as we unpack this story, we're going to see how Ehud's name is a challenge to both the original readers then and to us today. Where are we seeking our glory? Do you know, we really need to think about that question, because if we don't believe deep down that glory is found in God alone, well, we will end up the same way as Israel here. What are Israel doing in this book? What is the big issue? Well, they're compromising. And we'll do the same thing. Maybe not all at once, but gradually. We'll just take a slightly different route. We'll veer off course by a few degrees. And before we know it, we're miles away from where we should be. We're heading towards a completely different destination. Just think how easy it is to do this and not do that. Or perhaps to say this and be silent on that. We can think this, but be swept this way and that way by every issue that crosses our world. You see, where we think glory is affects every single decision that we make. So we need to be convinced that everything else is worthless. The temptation to chase after other things, success, approval, comfort, those are strong pulls, aren't they? And the truth is, we may not even realise we're doing it until we put this question front and centre. See, we really need to believe this. Really believe that any other glory is going to leave us empty. Glory sought in the wrong place, it doesn't just disappoint, it drags us down into the mess that we've created. In this story, at least someone in a complete and inglorious heap on the floor, doesn't it? So how does the passage show us this? Well, the first thing we learn is that glory is not found in false worship. Let's have a look at our text. See, Israel, they're fresh off their deliverance by Othniel. And now we're getting a masterclass in where not to find glory. Have a look at verse 12. Sets the stage for this tragic comedy. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. See, Othniel last week, he had delivered the people from their oppressor. Do you remember? The king of double wickedness. But that didn't stop the Israelites from, again, or continuing to do evil in the eyes of the Lord. To do the evil. But here's where it gets interesting. You see, God, in a twist of divine irony, he decides to strengthen Eglon. That is Eglon, the king of Moab. Yes, you heard that right. God empowers the very oppressor who's come to oppress Israel. What we have there is an Exodus story that's been remixed. Instead of hardening Pharaoh's heart to demonstrate God's power, God is beefing up Eglon to teach Israel a lesson. Spoiler alert, it's not going to end well, is it? But let's be totally clear here. It takes God to do that. Without God's intervention, Moab would have been seen off ages ago in the Bible. You see, Moab couldn't defeat Israel before. The last time we saw them in the Bible, their king was trying to outpower God with a prophet called Balaam. And he couldn't do it. But here, Moab succeeds because God is handing Israel over to this Eglon character. But Eglon, verse 13, well, he might have thought it was his clever political manoeuvring, joining forces with the Ammonites, the Amalekites. But that's not true, is it? It's God who's behind all of this. So what happens next? Well, Eglon and his allies, they attack Israel. They take over the city of palms. They conquer the land that Israel should have been ruling by now. Verse 14 tells us that the Israelites were subject to Eglon. How long were they subject for? 18 years. Can you remember how long you longed to be 18 for? 18 years. That's a whole decade longer than the previous guy. Now, that might be the way you read the story. A historical king, he comes in, he conquers the land, it lasts about 18 years. But here's the thing. The author of Judges, The author's purpose here, he wants us to see more than just historical facts. He's nudging us to take a closer look, because there's stuff here already that would have made the original readers smirk. Let's just pause and notice the humour here. Eglon, this powerful king, well, his name sounds suspiciously like the Hebrew word for calf. And then there's this word here used to describe the Israelites being subject to Eglon. Well, it's actually the word for worship. So what do we have here? We have Israel worshipping a calf. Does that sound familiar to anyone? Maybe some Exodus spells are ringing again. As I said, all the way through this book, that's going to happen. And we're going to see in a moment that Israel are bringing tribute. They're basically bringing offerings to this Eglon, this baby calf. That's the point, isn't it? See, back in the story of Othniel, Israel did evil by turning to Baal and Asherah. And things haven't changed. Now they think they're going to side with Eglon. They're bowing down to him. They've exchanged the glory of the immortal gods for a baby cow. So here we are, Israel, God's chosen people, bowing to the feet of King Calf. I mean, talk about a fall from grace, eh? They trade the glory of the Almighty for a bovine boss. Israel's misguided worship doesn't lead them to greatness. It leads them to the feet of a pagan king. Glory is not found in false worship. The story continues, verses 15 to 26, where we see glory is not found in useless idols. See, just as it seems that Israel is doomed to be Eglon's footstool forever, well, God comes and shakes it up. Enter our unlikely hero, Ehud, his name meaning, where is the glory? Spoiler alert, it is not with Eglon. Now, if you were casting for a hero, Ehud would not make the shortlist. The Bible introduces him as a left-handed man. Well, here, in Israel, it's like saying he's the wrong-handed man from the right-handed tribe. You see, Benjamin means the son of my right hand. Ehud here he looks pretty useless. He's not on the side that you'd expect to find glory on. But as always, God can rescue his people with one hand tied behind his back. See, Ehud's left-handedness stands out, especially because he is the son of Gera, the Benjamite. See, Benjamin, the son of my right hand. So let's just underline that. Ehud is the left-handed son of my right hand. I mean, you couldn't make this up, could you? But more than that, really detail, Benjamin here is actually spelled differently to normal, to emphasise the right hand. Ehud is described in the original here as the left-handed son of the right hand. It's really, really emphasised. The irony is meant to be thick. But the Israelites, well, they see him as, well, no glory there. He's just a delivery boy. Verse 15, they send him with a tribute, an offering to King Eglon. But Ehud is packing more than just tributes. Verse 16 reveals he's the expert in cutting-edge technology. See, Ehud has strapped a small double-edged sword to his right thigh. That is the thigh that an assassin would not use. Remember, he's left-handed. So off they go. They go present this offering to Eglon. And then we get another layer of irony. Look at verse 17. Eglon the king is described as a very fat man. Now, the word for fat here isn't the word for obesity. This is actually the word used for Daniel. Do you remember Daniel? When he refused the king's food, he had vegetables. It said the same word there. When Daniel only had vegetables, he was like this. But in Eglon's case here, this fat is hinting at something more, isn't it? Remember, his name is a calf. What is he? He's a fattened calf. A fattened calf ready for sacrifice. If only there was a knife nearby. Well, hang on a minute. Well, after presenting the offering, Ehud and the delivery team leave. But Ehud isn't done, is he? Verse 19. He passes by some stone idols, stone images, idols. He turns back. He says, Your Majesty, I have a secret message for you. Now, the Hebrew word for message and thing is the same. It's telling you all these word plays. It's ambiguous here. Eglon probably thinks that he's about to receive some kind of divine revelation, maybe from those stone images over there. So what does he do? Well, he sends everyone out of the room. And Ehud approaches and he says, with a sense of dramatic irony, verse 20, I have a message from God for you. Eglon's likely expecting something big, maybe a word from those stone idols he trusts in. Instead, Ehud delivers a very different kind of message or thing, doesn't he? A sword straight into Eglon's belly. See, Eglon, this supposedly powerful king, is portrayed here as a useless idol. And his end?
Well, if you thought glory was with Eglon, you're going to be proven wrong, aren't you?
Ehud's sword, it sinks so deeply in, it disappears into Eglon's body. And would you expect to read this in the Bible? His bowels discharge. It's a bit more graphic than that in the original. You see, it's not exactly a picture of royal glory, is it? The scene's comical. Ehud, our unlikely left-handed hero, he quietly slips away. He shuts the doors behind him. Meanwhile, Eglon's servants, they approach the locked doors and they smell something unpleasant. They assume the king is indisposed. And they wait. And they wait. And they wait before they finally open the door to find their mighty king a deflated mess all over the floor. Ehud escapes, he slips past those stone idols once more. The very ones that were meant to be protecting King Eglon there. And what are the idols doing? Nothing. They're useless. As useless as Eglon himself. They could not even stop a left-handed assassin with a homemade sword. You see? You see the irony here? This is what happens when you put your trust in useless idols. They promise glory, but they deliver disgrace. They offer protection, but they provide nothing. You see, in the end, they're as useful as a chocolate teapot. And that idea, it flows into Shamgar in the final verse. Shamgar's name, it connects him probably to a Canaanite idol. But he too defeats Israel's enemies, doesn't he? Do you see there? Someone who's named after a Canaanite idol, God using them to deliver his own people. Idols are useless, aren't they? Doesn't it seem ridiculous to chase after things that are ultimately going to disappoint? This story is here to tell us, where is the glory? Well, it's not found in useless idols. So where is glory found? We get that underlined in verses 27 to 31. Glory is found in following the Lord. Remember, idols, useless, powerless, smelly. Israel, helpless, hopeless without God. We know that. So they need God to graciously raise up a deliverer. But here we see that who you're with makes all the difference. There's so many word plays going on. Let me show you one more. Here's a fun one. The Hebrew word for blow, or the trumpet here, is the same word used for plunge when Ehud stabs Eglon. The author wants us to connect the plunging of the knife with the blowing of the trumpet. It's as if Ehud's knife is a echo of that moment, a reminder that victory belongs to the Lord. See, after he does that, after he kills the king, he says, follow me, verse 28. For the Lord has given Moab into your hands. There's a whole joke about hands as you go through this passage as well. You can go and look that up afterwards. But we've gone from left-handed, solo-handed Ehud to Israel's hands full of Moab. And notice that the moment the idol disappears, the Lord's name reappears again. I mean, the Lord hasn't been mentioned since verse 12. And the Israelites, as they follow explicitly the Lord's side there, they find glory. Verse 18, how many Moabites they strike down? 10,000. What a victory. And they're not just 10,000 Moabites. They are vigorous and strong Moabites. In fact, the Moabites are meant to remind us their ruler earlier. Vigorous and strong is a kind way of saying fat. They're connected to being fat like their ruler. They're on the inglorious side of the fight. They're like what they're following. See, false gods, they fatten us for a fall. But the true God equips for victory. And just when we think the story of misplaced and reclaimed glory is over, you get that surprising epilogue. Let's go back to Shamgar again, stage left, verse 31. After Ehud came Shamgar, son of Anath, who struck down 600 Philistines with an ox goad. He too saved Israel. As I said a minute ago, Shamgar's name connects us back to a Canaanite idol, but he ends up serving God's purposes. But how does he do it? How does this connect to the rest of the passage? Well, he beats 600 Philistines. Great, impressive. How? With an ox goad. That is a cattle prod. Something used to deal with animals. Maybe like cows that we've seen earlier. Again, it's another animal connection. See, Shamgar is dealing with the Philistines as if they're animals. Just like Eglon was dealt with like a little calf. If you follow the wrong side, it's like you're following animals. You could say you're beastly. That's what the book of Daniel would say. So it's a hilarious story. As we wrap up, we are meant to laugh at Eglon, aren't we? We're meant to laugh at the Moabites. But we shouldn't stop there. The point of Judges is to get us to take a good hard look at ourselves. Israel thought they could find glory in Eglon, a king who literally fell apart in the end. But before we judge them too quickly, we can end up doing the same thing, can't we? We might chuckle at Israel bowing down to King Carth, Eglon, but we could do the same thing. We might not prostrate ourselves before a statue or a portly monarch, but don't we often bow to the idea of career advancement, social media approval, financial security, and go on? We can convince ourselves that glory is found following them, and we can make decisions that end up with us compromising in the end. We're meant to remember Eglon's inglorious end. It's meant to be funny, so we remember it. You see, these false sources of glory can leave us just as deflated, just as exposed, just as messy. The warning of Judges is that anything we worship in place of God is going to disappoint. It is going to crumble. It is going to stink. Fame, fortune, false gods fail. Success, status, security can end up with nothing. Ehud's story here forces us to take a good look in the mirror. So where are you seeking your glory? Is it in things that can fall apart, like Eglon? Or is it in the unshakable, undefeatable glory of the one true God? Just picture an Israelite boasting about mighty King Eglon until someone interrupts and goes, wait, didn't you hear what happened to that guy? And talk about awkward. In the end, only God delivers true victory. Everything else, idols, achievements, success, they're going to leave us like Eglon's servants, standing outside the locked door, confused, and waiting for something glorious to happen. But when we seek glory in the true God, we find more than victory. We find purpose. We find identity. We find a lasting joy that no fattened calf could ever give us. We need to know this so we avoid compromising, so that we find our glory, our righteousness in Christ alone. In fact, that's exactly what another Benjamite later in the Bible has to say. Hear Paul's words here in Philippians 3:8, seemingly using a connected word here. Philippians 3 verse 8, what is more, I consider everything a loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ is my Lord, for whose sake I have lost all things. I consider them garbage, that I may gain Christ. You have to wonder whether he had Ehud, one of his ancestors, in mind when he wrote that sentence. But we need to hear that, don't we? We need to heed that going forwards. We need to find our glory in God alone. And we need God's help to do that, don't we? So shall we turn to discuss and pray? Here's some things you could pray in light of the passage. I'll leave it to you though, and I'll call us back together after that.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. Any questions can be sent to podcast@david-couch.com. I'll see you again next time.